My name's Johnny, and I'm an alcoholic. I almost feel like Elizabeth Taylor's next husband. I know what's expected of me, but I don't know quite how to do it. You know, just... But I talk about going to any length. This is about 5 miles beyond any length, for Christ's sake. Plodding through the snow and, you know, coming back from the restaurant was an adventure all in itself. And nobody can see. And Alex says, I turned here. And Gene says, no. Gene's from Chicago. What the hell does he know about where we're at? It's just wonderful. Snow has done a wonderful thing. It took all the half measures group, moved them down the road. I could be here with all you sincere people. Maybe you don't have anywhere to go either, for Christ's sake. If I could have figured out some way to get a 6 o'clock plane, I'd have been gone, for Christ's sake. But I am glad to be here. The story of the deal is, and I don't know how much of it I said today, because I really haven't got an idea of what I said all day, to tell you the truth. I feel like the babblings of a madman, for Christ's sakes, going on through this thing. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do. I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous never restored me to anything. It never took me back to a place where I was, because I've never been here before. I feel like a little old man who... used to be a little old man who lived in my papa's hometown in Indiana. He thought he was a goofy old guy. He just wandered around, and papa told me that he used to make fun of him. And he said to him one time, making fun of him, and the guy stopped and looked at him. He said, no, he said, you don't understand. I really don't live here. My home is in heaven. And I kind of feel like that sometime in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I really don't belong in the world out there. My home is really in heaven, because I have been rocketed into a dimension of living that it's really hard to kind of describe unless you've been rocketed into that dimension. Unless you've ever been in that place Earl's talking about, that fantastic magic thing that happens when somebody that you're really with, who's new in Alcoholics Anonymous, just opens up like a little flower and starts to enjoy this thing. And then you really learn a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous and how powerless you really are, and the sole purpose of what we're to do here, we got to stay sober and carry the message. Now, I knew none about that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been searching for a long, long time for an answer to what was wrong with me. As far back as I can remember, in my earliest awakening moments, my earliest recollection of life, I knew there was something basically wrong with me, but I didn't have a clue what it was. I don't know, I had all the symptoms of this killer disease, but I didn't know it was a disease. I didn't know that being restless and irritable and discontent was the symptoms of this deadly disease called alcoholism, because I hadn't been here. You know, you can't find out the nature of what it is if you don't examine what it is. And I didn't know. I just wandered around. I hear people talk about feeling different. Hell, I was different. I acted different. I was a snotty little kid. I was angry and I was hostile, and I didn't like where I was around. I didn't like the people that I was around, and I looked for all places. The only thing that was decent in my life when I was a child was my grandmother. My grandmother lived till she was 90 years old. She never took a drink or smoked a cigarette in her life. If my grandmother was here today, she'd probably say, 36 years, no big deal. I've been sober for 90. You know, I mean, God, I look at her and say, yeah, Granny, but a couple of times you should have taken a drink, for Christ's sakes. I know that. But she was a wonderful old lady. My grandmother got the same thing that we've been talking about here every Sunday by going over and sitting in her church. My grandmother got the same thing that I get in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't get what my grandmother got when I sit in her church. I don't know why that is. I haven't figured it out yet. My grandmother got it, and a couple of guys sitting next to her got that, too. I didn't get it. You hear that? Oh, shit. Every time I hear a phone ring, I look around to see if anybody else has. You know, just you don't realize what a tremendous relief it is when somebody gets up to go answer it. Because I just... I remember that as a child. I remember how anticipated and how excited I was. I was going to go sit with my grandmother, and I was going to feel the way my grandmother looked when she came back from church. I just knew that. I knew there was a special something that happened to my grandmother while she was gone for those couple hours. I could see that. I wasn't blind. I'm looking for this thing, for this answer. I'm searching everywhere for it. And to my great disappointment, I sat in a church with my grandmother, and nothing happened to me. I just got more angry and more hostile and more upset and more distant, and more apart from it. And I don't know, one day sitting on the back porch of my grandpa's house, a magic thing happened to me. My grandfather set down his fruit jar where he was drinking whiskey out of this whiskey that he'd made or stole or whatever he did with it. And by some act of faith, I suppose, I took a drink of my grandfather's whiskey. And it changed my life. My life would never be the same again. Till many years later, till I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, something a little over 20 years later. You would never know anything. To me, it was like getting on an elevator to hell. I mean, talk about getting out of the frying pan and going into the fire. It was such an elusive thing, because I've come to discover, like I told you today, that alcohol has some type of an abnormal reaction in my life. That's what makes me an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic because for the next 20 years I created mayhem out there in the world and destroyed everything that came in contact with me. I'm an alcoholic because I have this abnormal reaction to alcohol. Alcohol has this seemingly ability to do something for me it doesn't do for everybody that drinks it. Now, I didn't know that when I took a drink. I didn't know that alcohol reacted in my system differently than it reacted to other people. I just know that it went down inside of me and kind of stilled the screaming madness and brought it all together and put that thought in my head, I don't give a damn anymore. I don't care what's happening. I don't care if mom and dad are out there and drunk and they're going to come in and kick me around. I don't care what happens. I don't care if my uncles are in penitentiaries, my aunts in them whorehouses. I don't care. I don't care if I'm ashamed of these people. I don't care about. I don't remember caring about anything, and that's the great thing that alcohol did for me. It made me not care. I just got what a tremendous thing. I don't have to care. I don't have to feel. I don't have to, And I didn't realize for the next 20 years that I was in bondage. I didn't realize that I had been enslaved in that moment, searching for an illusion that I would create and pursue into the gates of insanity and death, because I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know that I was bodily and mentally different from my fellows. I didn't know that I was different from my grandma. I love my grandma. But I didn't know that I was bodily and mentally different from her. I didn't know that alcohol reacted in me the same way that reacts in alcohol, and wouldn't react like that in my grandmother, because my grandmother never drank. She never needed to drink. I didn't realize when I took a drink. And what got me into all those troubles all those years was not the physical reaction I got from alcohol. It's that inseparable craving that was created once I ingested this alcohol into my system. The book calls it a phenomenon of craving. The doctor says I have that, the little doctor who wrote about it. That once I take a drink of alcohol, I'm powerless not to take the next one. I start to drink to overcome a craving that's beyond all human power and beyond all human help. And also beyond all human understanding. Nobody in all the years that alcohol and alcoholics have been under microscopes and all these kind of things, to analyze them and look at them and use them for experiments and all these kind of things that they've done to us for all these years, nobody has ever been able to come up with why my body reacts to alcohol differently than 9 out of the other 10 people who drink it. They don't know, I don't know, and neither does anybody else. They have never figured a way in this world to make my body different from what it is. Nobody's ever been able to figure. Nobody's ever been able to come up with the answer to that, just like they've never been able to come up with the answer to a lot of unanswerable questions. The great magic of life, I suppose, for people like me, is that someday I sit in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings long enough to find out what was wrong with me. But I didn't know. I spent the next 20 years of my life doing the same thing over and over and over again, chasing this elusive answer for what was wrong with me. Trying to come to that place in life where I no longer had to do the thing that I was compelled to do to maintain the lifestyle that I lived. Because what happened to me is when I took a drink, the drink took a drink, and then the drink took me. I have never one time in my life ever sobered up willingly. Right up to this very moment, I have never quit drinking. I have always had to be stopped. Always. I am the classic example the book talks about called Self-Will Run Riot. Once I ingest a drink of alcohol into my system, I'm like a rocket ship. I'm gone. I have no control over what I do, what I don't do. I only live with a thought in my head, either get loaded or get the money to get loaded on, and I got to pursue that thing into the gates of insanity or death. And what happened to me when I took a drink of alcohol the first time happened to me when I took a drink of alcohol the last time. My first drink of alcohol, 3 days later, I was pulled out from underneath a bridge and stood in front of a judge and sentenced to the Hutchinson State Reform School in Kansas. Many years ago, I went back and went underneath that bridge that I was pulled out from underneath there. I was back in Lawrence, Kansas, that little town I was born in. And I made it my business to go in that little bridge and try to figure out what I was doing that day. Just trying to recreate the scene. And I never will forget it, because on one of the pillars underneath that bridge was somebody taking a spray can and written these words: "Lost boys live forever." I have never forgot that. Lost boys live forever. Nobody knows where they're at, but they live forever. And it was the most amazing thing to me. The best I could piece that out is that I was on my way to my good grandma's house. See, I had two grandmas. Grandma Bradley, who had all these drunks in her family. Then I had my good grandma, Grandma Harris, who did not have drunks in her family except for my dad. They were good people. I was on the way to my good grandma and grandpa's house. And I just stopped off the bridge for a little nappy poo, I suppose, or what a little 7-8-year-old kids do who are drunk, puking and wetting their pants and doing stuff and sick. And you just lay down and try to get well, I guess. But I was pulled out from underneath that bridge and stood in front of a judge and sent to that reform school. And 20 years later, they pulled me off a car in Compton and stood me in front of a judge and sent me to 20 years in the penitentiary. And every time I drank during that whole 20-year period of time, the same thing happened. There were reform schools and more reform schools and junior penitentiaries and more junior penitentiaries and insane asylums. All these things were the sum total of my drinking. And I didn't know that I was afflicted with this thing. And somewhere during this period of time, I was introduced to the wonderful world of chemicals. I was given pills to drink and eat and drink along with my wine, and for the last 14 years of my life, I was ingesting heroin into my system as long as I could and often as I could until they come and got me. I did everything that's required in that type of a lifestyle. I lived out in the streets and destroyed things and people and places and things. I had many names before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, not aliases, just names that I thought were macho. I was called Hueto Loco, and that means the white nut in Mexican. I thought, God, that's macho. Well, I like that, man. I just wanted to be crazy. I wanted to be known as crazy because I acted crazy. I would do anything. I don't know why it was within me. I had this violent nature about me. I would do anything that they suggested that I do. I'd do anything just to be a part of something. I thought for a long time I was a Mexican. Had been, you know, don't look like a Mexican, but I thought I was a Mexican. I had blue-eyed Mexican. I told him I was Castilian. It was just anything to make him go along. Just any old kind of the deal. That's the way I just lived my life. And I lived in these barrios and these ghettos, and I lived in institutions and nut houses. I ran the streets like a wild thing. I destroyed things, people, places, and things. I'm a taker basically by nature of things and a user of people by nature. So naturally, I'm a loser. And I came to one day, and a little over 37 years ago, about this time of the year, really, crawling around in a cell in solitary confinement in a maximum security penitentiary, drifting in and out of total insanity. I was 27 years old. in everything that was near and dear to me in my life, every type of opportunity, there were many of them that came my way, and through God's grace, I had literally destroyed or just overlooked and went about my business pursuing this elusive thing that I couldn't quite put my finger on, this elusive identity or this elusive answer for whatever it was that was destroying me and mine. And what was significant about that to me today, and I was thinking about it today as I was standing here. You know, 37 years ago when I came to in that cell, there wasn't a single solitary soul left upon the face of this earth that would send me a penny postcard. They were all gone. They were all gone. I used them all up and destroyed them all, and they should have been gone, really. I didn't have any right to have them back or to have anything coming back into my life. I still don't have any right to do anything just because, or have anything just because I was lucky enough to stumble into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous 36 years ago, because I can't even take any credit for coming here. My brain had exploded in a courtroom a year prior to coming to in that cell. The judge called me what I was. He called me a blood-sucking parasite in society. He said I had no right being around decent people. He was right. He told a woman sitting in the courtroom who was pregnant with my oldest child that if she cared anything at all about the child she carried inside her, but I'd never be allowed to lay eyes on it. And he was right. He had right. The only records and evidence he had was the pieces of paper in front of him. It's called a record. In my case, it was a telephone book, for Christ's sakes. Everything that had been known to man, everything that you could do to another human being, was in my record. I had done it to him. And there it was, sitting there. The man was right. But you see, that's the first time I had ever heard it said. I'd always known it, but I had never heard it. There is a difference between knowing it and hearing it, particularly in an open courtroom, when you are being the center of attention, if you really want to know the truth, and everybody's looking at you. I mean, you know, you stand there and, you know, stand there and call me a killer or a drug dealer or a white slaver or something. That's what I am. Right on. You call me a blood-sucking parasite in society. What happened to me is what happens to people like me who are sober, who could no longer face reality and could no longer stand the truth about themselves, who have seen themselves as they really are and have heard them described as they've always known they always were. See, I have never lied to me about me. I have always known what I was. I never pretended to be anything else than what I was. A kid who run the streets and who would do anything to get ahead in the world. Out there in the world that I lived in, which was not the overworld. That's the way I lived my life. And so when I was faced with that, my brain just checked out. And I went through a series of insane blackouts and rages and violent behaviors. And that's how I ended up in solitary confinement, because you don't behave like that even in penitentiaries. They lock you away from the people to protect the prisoners from people like me. That's really macho, isn't it? And how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous is a very strange thing. I was pulled in front of this associate warden in charge of custody, and he told me without a doubt that I was probably the most corrupt thing he'd ever seen in his life. Didn't mean anything to me. I told him if he believed all those things about me, why didn't he lock me back up in my cell and let me get some rest? But I kind of like it in solitary. I can sing to myself and fantasize and do all the things, do push-ups and sit-ups and try to get myself in shape so I could fight the ghost in the middle of the night, I suppose. I don't know what I was doing in there. But he said, I tell you what I'm going to do, smart guys. There's two buses leaving this institution this week, and whichever one gets there first, you're going to be on it. So I had become too corrupt to live in a maximum security penitentiary. That's really kind of a wonderful way to tell a guy you're really rotten, for Christ's sakes. You know, this bus, one of them was going to, the one I was supposed to be on was supposed to be the adjustment center in Folsom, which is the end of the line for people in the state of California. But there was a bus that was going there, had a flat tire. And the next bus got there, it was going down to a compulsory rehabilitation center in the southern part of the state called the Tehachapi State Prison, where they force-fed you group therapy. I'd been in group therapy for 9 months, and I had this solitary confinement. I was talking to me and everybody in there. I thought that was kind of a unique idea. And I got on this bus, and I'm on this bus, and I'm going down there. It's about this time of the year, and I got a pair of old white overalls. And this I never forget. Every time I think about it, I think about this. I think about pulling in. We had a rest stop, not a rest stop, in this bus trip where we pulled into San Luis Obispo. There's an old place in San Luis Obispo for elder prisoners who are too old to cut the mustard anymore, I guess. So they just kind of put them out to pasture there, and they just wander around in black things and carpet slippers. And I remember sitting on that bus that day. I'm 27 years old. And I'm sitting there, and this guy came across. I never will forget him. He had silver hair. He had a black sweater, khaki pants, a white shirt, and a pair of carpet slippers on. And he had a coffee pot with him, and he poured us a cup of coffee. He gave us a cup of coffee. He came aboard the bus. We couldn't get off. And my thought that day as I looked at that man was this: I wonder how long it's going to be before the state of California or the federal government puts me out to pasture for the rest of my life. That's not a very progressive thought for a 27-year-old man. And what is significant about that to me is that I didn't have a clue what was wrong with me. Nothing. Nobody had ever called me an alcoholic. Nobody even insinuated that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't popular then. This is 1959, 58, somewhere around there. They weren't telling me that I should go find this deal. Nobody was talking about it. We weren't the most popular dame in town in those days. And so I went down to this institution. And one day on a Sunday, I was sitting out in this yard with a couple of my partners, and we were cutting up touches that we do in institutions. That means we just sit around and lie to one another. And, you know, everybody's trying to outbig the other guy in there, you know. One guy said he stole $10,000. Another guy stole $30,000. And another guy stole $1,000,000. And another guy stole $2,000,000. And the next thing you know, we're bumming cigarettes off of one another, the big-time gangsters. Nobody got 2 cents. But we're sitting there talking in the millions and spending in the thousands and ain't got 2 cents between us. And I looked up and I saw a bunch of women walk across the yard. And I got up and followed them. The most significant thing about that to me is none of my old cronies sitting there said to me, "Where are you going?" Because they were like me. They didn't care anyhow. Nobody, if somebody had said, "Hey, man, you know, where are you going with them winos?" I'd have said, "Oh, that's what they are? Sit down and play big six. Let's play some dominoes. Get it on. Talk tough." Nobody said that to me. These are a series of odd things in my life that absolutely propelled me to show you that I had no power or no concern or nothing to do with my coming to Alcoholics Anonymous whatsoever. And I came here not knowing where I was going, what I was going to get into. And on the fourth day of November, 1959, I wandered into a room very much like this. It's an old Quonset hut of a building. Sit down in the back row of that meeting, and just like the day I took my first drink, and my life changed. That day, I sit down in here, and my life went in a different direction. If you'd asked me that day, "Do you know, man, 36 years plus from now, you're going to be in a little town in Virginia talking about Alcoholics Anonymous," I'd hit you in the head with something. It's so far-fetched to think that I'm going to be anywhere but in a cell or in a cemetery plot outside of one of those penitentiaries or in some insane asylum for the rest of my natural life. It was beyond belief that I would ever be anything. And so I sit down in this room. I sit back there in the back row in what I lovingly like to call my throne of contempt. And because I wasn't going to spend a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know what it was. I saw two big A's up there. I thought some kind of an anti-aircraft brigade or American Airlines or something. I didn't know what it was. And the guy sitting next to me, and I hit him, and he said, "What do you want?" I said, "What is this?" He says, "It's Alcoholics Anonymous." I kind of hunched down in my seat. I didn't want anybody to see the big gangster hanging around with them winos. And It was kind of a sick thing, and I sit up and wait for the women to tell their racy stories. And they kind of threw me a curve. One of them got up there, an elderly lady, and said she drank for a long time. And I said to myself, you could look at her and see she'd been somewhere for a long time. Said I used to drink. I said, I'll bet you did. Bad stuff, too. And there I sit. You know, just the most amazing thing about an alcoholic of my type, with the arrogance that I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous, is deadly. Because I almost missed the whole ball game here. With that arrogance and that defiance, and my case is different, and it really hadn't anything to do with it. I just didn't know. I had no way of knowing. I had never acted or reacted any differently in my life. So how would I to know that I was sitting in a room looking at a group of people who were going to change my life? How would I know that? I had never been here. I'd never heard about it. I'd never been called alcoholic. I had no premise about ever doing anything different than what I was doing. But there I sat that day in November 1959, staring at the answer, although I didn't know it, that I had sold my soul for. But I did not recognize the answer because I didn't know what the problem was. I didn't know I was alcoholic. If you'd asked me, I'd have probably told you I was a dope fiend or some other thing that had a little ring of machoism about it, you know, an imitation Mexican or something, I don't know. And there I sit, and I just almost missed my first meeting, was almost my last meeting. I never have forgot what it was like to be a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I've been here all these years. I have never forgot my first thoughts when I came here. I have never forgot the attraction that I had for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Whatever it was that they had when they came to this penitentiary to talk to me that day was something I had never seen. I didn't recognize it. They had sort of an easy step about them. You know what I mean? They kind of walked with an air about them. I don't quite know how to explain it to you. It's something that I would like to maybe be like or whatever. But it's just kind of being easy. I know a friend of mine used to say, talk stepping out easy. That's what just doing it easy. And that's the way they do it. I was always around people who were uptight all the time. You know what I mean? They're just, you know, it's always something. Say something to them, they hit you or stab you or shoot you or do something. You know what I mean? If you didn't hit them or stab them or shoot them first. You know, these people were kind of at ease. And although I didn't figure them out, I didn't understand what they were doing because I had never seen people like this before in my life. I never in my life ever saw anybody who ever gave anything just for the hell of giving it. I never saw anybody in my life who ever did anything for free and for fun. Everybody had a hook. Everybody wanted something. Everybody got their hand out for something. I never saw people like this. I didn't understand them. And when I asked them what they got out of coming up there, they told me what I could answer the question. I wouldn't have to ask it. They gave me riddles to talk. They talked to me in riddles. To me, it seemed like riddles. How would you like to go up and say somebody, to the guy, what do you get out of coming up here anyhow? You come type of a sickle? Like look at the animals in the cages? You expect somebody to jump back and hit you. And he looked at me and smiled and said, son, when you can answer that question, you won't have to ask it. It just takes all the wind out of your sails. You want some psychological answer. Well, I come up here to take you and put you on the golden highway to life and rock you to sleep and cradle to deep. And do all, you know, you want something. Do you want them to sing Onward Christian Soldiers or something? You want them to do something. The guy tells you stupid stuff like, when you can answer that question, you won't have to ask it. Jesus. In a simple statement, the man explained Alcoholics Anonymous to me and why it's so hard for people like me to grasp. It's too damn simple. I want some, my brain demands that I have some type of a ego-stimulating lesson to be taught, to learn, to convey, to whatever it is, to get no credit for anything that's happened to me, to get to only to do these simple actions that somebody has imposed on me to do is almost beyond my intellectual capacity to comprehend when I came here. So there I sat. That close to dying, but attracted to the people of Alcoholics Anonymous.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your cassette over at this time for side two.
See, I could pay as much attention to her as she's paying to me. I'll do that. I'll just talk to you. It's an amazing thing to me. Just an amazing thing to me that I'm even sober and well in my life, because I don't deserve to be. I haven't done anything in my life prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous that would superimpose me from that thing on the back row of that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, a selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, egotistical idiot who lived in a world all by myself, completely obliterated from everybody in the world around me except for me. There was nothing in my world but me. Nothing in my world but me. And to be transferred from that to where I am today, I'll tell you this, they ain't getting no buses up to bring you here, I'll tell you that. There ain't no bus ride to get here. You can't get from where I was 36 years ago to where I am today. You just can't get there. There ain't no trains or planes or transportation or nothing. It's the most amazing thing. Sometimes I look back on it and I don't believe of what's happened to me in my life. I really, really down deep in my heart, do not believe that I deserve anything, any goodness, because nothing I did before I came to you good people would entitle me to anything that's happened to me in this life. And so I want to do anything that I can do to stay here. And I'm like Earl. My great, great pleasure is sitting in a room somewhere with an alcoholic watching the lights come on. I love talking to drunks. It's the most amazing thing I know. Fat ones, skinny ones, old ones, young ones, goofy ones. I like the crazy ones. I really do. I was talking to a guy, I was telling people about it last night. I have this guy I sponsor, and he sponsors a lot of guys. He'd tell me that, he said he had this real problem. He wanted to talk to me. He said, would you take a little walk? So we would take a little walk out through the parking lot, and he said, God, he said, I just have a problem. I said, well, he says, it seems like I get a hold of the sickest people in the world to work with. The sickest. I said, well, I really don't know what to tell you, but I know how you feel. He was... Every time I'm near him, he hurts me by telling that story to his friends. But I don't know. I many things have happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, but like I told you today, the greatest thing that happened to me is to discover what was wrong with me. To come to really realize way down deep in my heart that I was afflicted with this deadly killer disease, and to have the ability or the sanity left to realize that I was smack dab into the solution, that the problem had been removed. I knew what the problem was. It was no longer significant in my life. That here is the solution. I must do these things if I want to live sober for the rest of my life, which I do. I want to maintain some degree of comfort in my life, and the only comfort I've ever had in my life is since I've been with you. I have never been a comfortable, kindly giving person in my life. It's not of my nature. I'm an alcoholic to give just for the joy of giving it, but yet I do. I mean, there are people in this world, you know, that all my life before I came to you and for a long time after I was here, I never said I loved anybody, to any human being upon the face of this earth. I never told anybody that I loved them. I guess maybe because I thought love was some type of a weakness, and if I told you I love you, you were going to be able to use me. That's all I ever saw. People who said they loved one another, did they just use one another up? They used love as some type of a branding post to tie their sicknesses together, I guess. I don't know. But I do love people today. There are people in this world that I love absolutely and totally unconditionally. Just totally unconditionally. They don't have to do anything to stay sober, and the necessary for them to stay sober. I just love them. And it's not everybody. I'm not so far-fetched to believe that I have that ability to love everybody like that, because I'm still judgmental sometimes, and still critical sometimes, and still self-seeking and self-serving a lot of the time. And all the character defects I have in alcoholics, brought to Alcoholics Anonymous, I still have. And from time to time, they just kind of go on the nod back there somewhere, I guess, and kind of subside, but I've always had those things. I remember one time when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's an old lady by the name of Myrtle Snyder, who I talked about a little today, who I took on a ride one night to save my life. I loved that old lady, and I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous when I came out of the penitentiary. I'd only see her once in a while at this meeting on Tuesday night, and every time I'd see her, I'd run up to her and I'd say, she'd say, "How you doing, honey?" And I'd say, "Mom, I'm going to the meeting over here, man, and I'm going to the meeting over there, I'm going on to that panel, and I'm making coffee over here, and I'm washing cups, and I'm doing all this." And she'd say, "I love you, honey." I'd say, "Yeah, I understand that, but I'm going to the meeting over there, and I'm going to the meeting over there, and I'm doing all this." And she'd say, "Yeah, but I love you, honey." You know? And I said, "Yeah, but you know, Mom," she said, "I love you." I said, "Honey, you don't have to do anything to earn that love. I just love you. You don't even have to stay sober for me to love you." Oh. Jesus. And I walk around here in Alcoholics Anonymous and tell people, "I just love you, you know. Just love you, you know." People I sponsor, "I just love you." And people get up, take their birthday cakes. They better mention my name. That's not love. That's recognition and egotism. But if I stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous long enough, everything will come to pass here. There was a young man that I made a call on in a reform school one time, and his mother lived right down the street from us, and I went out to visit him at a reform school, and he came out and he got sober. And he was like the only son I'd never had, and maybe like the baby brother that I'd killed when he was 17. And it was kind of like one of those things where you just, you know, like one of your own kids or something. And he got sober, and God, he was a tremendous thing. He started out working in a car wash, and he got sober, and he went into selling clothes, and he became very successful with all this kind of stuff and money. And I loved him, and he gave a great talk in AA. And one day I'm going to go speak at a meeting, I picked him up one Sunday morning to take him to a breakfast meeting with me. He went everywhere with me for a couple of years. And I got in the car, and he said, "How you doing, Alan?" He said, "Oh, I'm doing fine, Papa." I said, I got loaded Friday. And I said, "Well, that's okay, Alan. I love you." He said, "But you don't understand. I got loaded yesterday. Too. That's okay, Alan. I understand. You know, I love you." He said, "You don't seem to understand. I'm loaded right now." And I heard myself say something that is absolutely and totally foreign to a human being of my ilk. I said to him, "That's all right. I love you. You don't even have to stay sober for me to love you. I just love you." I couldn't even believe I said it. It was not of me, it's not of myself to have those type of things come from this self-centered, self-seeking, egotistical idiot who's only interested in his own comfort and his own desires. To bring a transformation about something like that from a selfish, self-centered person who lives in no other world but his own with nobody else but himself, to be able to even say anything like that without an audience is beyond belief, and it's a long, long way. I didn't bring that in here. I didn't bring those type of feelings and joys an understanding or a belief in a God or a belief in you or a belief in this program or belief in anything when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was beyond belief. There were no beliefs left. There were no tomorrows because tomorrow was hell. I lived in hell every day of my life prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time after I was here. And always tomorrow was going to be just like today. And all I could do was just get through one day. It was a struggle to even make it without wanting to kill myself. And now I wake up every morning with a joy of life that's beyond description. It's the most amazing thing that I know of. Alcoholics Anonymous is the most fantastic, wonderful thing that's ever happened to me in my life. Now, everything in my life has not been sweet cakes and honey bunches, and I haven't been tripping down the light fantastic just all these years, just onward and upward. I've had a lot of strange things happen to me. My wife committed suicide when I was 5 years sober, left me with two little kids that I didn't know anything about how to raise. I had a tough time recovering from that, but my sponsor told me something that night. He told me that God gives big crosses to big horses, and he gives little crosses to guys named John. I went home that day and tried to figure out how big my cross was. You know, you have to find out where you fit out there, I guess. And I didn't have a cross. I didn't have a cross at all. I'd been sober. I was sober, and I'd been sober many times. And just because there was a little cloud in the sky that day did not mean that the sun was never going to shine. The way I lived all my life before I got to You Good People and from time to time after I got here was this. It's like looking at that snowstorm out there and thinking, God, the sun ain't never going to shine. Man, it's going to be stormy for the rest of my life. I'm going to have to walk through this cold, wet crap for the rest of my life. The sun ain't never going to shine. Just hunker down. But even though it's snowing out there today, I know there's a sun up there. Some sun shining someplace. I know that. And I know the sun's going to shine tomorrow. And if the sun shines tomorrow, I'll be warmed by its sunshine. It's just part of the seasons of life. There's spring, summer, fall, and winter. And sometimes our lives are like that. Spring, summer, fall, and winter. And sometimes in the summer of my life, every day is sunshine and every day is roses. Sometime in the spring, time of my life, everything is coming up new. And sometime in the fall, it seems like everything is asleep and dying and old. And sometime in the summer or winter, it's just like it's hibernating someplace. Why it is that I've been sober and been given the gift of sobriety, I don't know. I haven't figured it out, and I really don't dwell on it much. I'm just very grateful that I had an opportunity to come to you in November 1959 and stay here. I do not believe that gratitude is a word. I believe that gratitude is an answer. I believe it's some type of an action. And the guy I know that says gratitude is a verb, I don't even know what verbs are, but some type of thing in the language, I guess. But I believe that gratitude is an action. My sponsor used to say to me, what you are speaks so loud I can't hear a word you say. Don't tell me what you're going to do, show me what you're going to do. Show me how much you love Alcoholics Anonymous by what you do. Show me how much Alcoholics Anonymous has given you by what you do. Don't tell me how much Alcoholics Anonymous has done. Show me by your actions what Alcoholics Anonymous has created in your life. The more you do here, the more you seem to have gotten here. The people who do the most in Alcoholics Anonymous seem to have gotten the most out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they cannot repay anything for what they get for one day. No matter what I do for the rest of my natural life, I could never put enough back into Alcoholics Anonymous for the measure of pleasure that I've gotten out of this thing just today. No matter how many times I go to meetings, how many people I work with, how many newcomers I have, how many nothing will ever repay for the things that I got. Just to be able to sit over there and watch Earl take a chip for 41 years and watch him give one to his son for 10. Jesus Christ, where would you see things like that before? You don't see it unless you're here. Pity the people who aren't. Pity the people who will come to us and never see anything like that, and if they see it, they just think it's some old fool has nothing better to do than go to meetings. And will sit in these meetings with you and I and never know the full measure of what's here. My Papa Chuck used to say that this thing is like looking into the sun. If you could see it as an entirety, it would blind you. He said to me that there's always as much ahead of you as there is behind you. More and more. And I was telling a little story about this to one of the guys who was really fascinated with my papa. And he, I remember one time I drove down to Laguna Beach where he was at, and I had some very, 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 very pressing, critical problem that was going to kill me if I didn't get an answer. And I drove down there, and I got there, and he's bowling on the lawn. He bowled on the lawn. And so I sit there going crazy waiting to get this thing out. And, you know, and he finally came over and said, oh, we had a cup of coffee. And I laid this big, horrendous thing on him, whatever it was. I didn't know how important it was because I don't even remember what it was. But I laid it on him. Matter of life and death. Know it. He looked at me, and he smiled, and he said, look out there, son. He said, what do you see? I said, the ocean. No, no, no. How far is it to the horizon? I said, I don't know, you know. I'm a foot soldier from the ghetto, for Christ's sake. I don't know anything about the ocean. He said, 7 miles out there, son. I said, good, that's great, Pop. I figured he was in the sun too long. He's getting a little old. And he didn't quite hear my problem. So we were going to go back up on the hill and sit in a chair and visit. And so I thought, well, get him out of the sun, get him a cup of coffee or some iced tea or something. He'll calm down and get his faculties back, and I'll talk to him. And so we went back up on the hill, and we're sitting up there. He got this big window, and I'm sitting in one chair. He's sitting in the other, and we're looking out over this beautiful scenery, the ocean and Catalina and all these kind of things. And I figured, well, we've been here for a while. I hit him again with it. Papa? Yes, son. I went through a big, terrible dilemma that I'm in. It's going to kill me if I don't know what's going on. And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, look out the window. I said, oh, shit, here we go again. But I got him this time, right? He said, how far is it out there? And I said, 7 miles. He said, no, you don't seem to understand, do you? He said, from that point to that point is 26 miles. I thought, geez, that's really great. I've got a lesson in geography and distance now. I know a lot about a lot of things. And I must have had one of those puzzled looks that all goofs like me have on their face when they can't figure out what's been said to them. He said, you don't understand, do you, son? And I said, no, Papa, I really don't. He says, the higher you go, the further you see. And the further you see, the more there is to see. It's infinity. On and on and on and on. And isn't it amazing that in our program of Alcoholics Anonymous it says this, that we grow along spiritual lines. That my life today is much more clear today. And my purpose for living and doing whatever it is much more clear today than it was 10 years ago. Or 20 years ago. Or 5 years ago. Maybe even a year ago, which is proof positive that if I stay here and stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous, there will always be as much ahead of me as there is behind me. And that if I could see my life in its entirety, it would be like looking into the sun. I would not be able to see. It would blind me. I believe that. And so sometimes I just put on my sunglasses and walk right along with you, and people like Earl, and people who've gone before me, and following them footsteps and watch them and see what they do to see if I'm missing anything that's going to get me from 36 to 41, because I want to get to 41. I want to get to 51. I want to live forever in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to be here. I want to be here with you. The life is really good. I guess that if I was able to, And I've been trying to for the last 6 hours, I suppose, to stand here and tell you all the things that I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. And all the things I would like to thank God for is that I'd like to thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I really would. Because I do believe it's God's gift to us. But I think more importantly than anything that I ever want to say to you again is this. If I could really do anything today, I would really like to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for my God. And I thank you for allowing me to be here and share with you. And I hope we all live in happy, wonderful destiny from this day on. God bless you and stay out of the snow.